My name is Peter, recovered alcoholic. Grateful to be alive and sober and part of a sacred place called Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank Sheldon for stalking me to be here for the last few weeks to get here. Glad to be here and share the good news that was brought to me. June 23rd, 1988 is when 11 God separated me from alcohol. Very grateful for this gift of sobriety, very grateful for the many things that this loving God has brought to me, but especially grateful for the many things God has removed from me. And that's basically my ideas about what my life's supposed to look like and where I'm supposed to be and what money I'm supposed to have and basically running my own show. That has little by slowly been removed from me. I would love to report to you has been completely removed to me, but I get my own way sometimes. I do have a home group. It's called No Problems, Just Solutions in Boca Raton. And we meet on Wednesday night at 7:30. It's a little big book study. I love being there on Wednesday. We meet at 7:30, but we're there at 6. And we break the meeting up at 8:30 and we're there after 9. It kind of reminds me of the old days when I was getting sober. Nobody headed home. They hung out and waited for the new people, and we kind of mingled and fellowshipped. And what I love about Alcoholics Anonymous, one of the many things I loved about Alcoholics Anonymous, is the music of us before the meeting starts. It's the soul food. It's the soul music. You can hear it because based on many of our stories, we're not supposed to be here. And then the fellowship and the gratitude that follows, it's music for the soul. And I really enjoy that. I get to experience a lot of that at my home group. I'm currently sponsoring 11 guys, and my sponsor is out of St. Paul. His name is Bob Bazan. He just made 58 years sober a couple of weeks ago. So he's a real old timer, and his lessons have been invaluable to me. So I'm so just so grateful. My wife is in recovery almost as long as I am, and where God has put us right in the middle of AA with the people we sponsor, meetings we get to, the conferences we get to, is just a great way of life. I could not fathom another way of living. I know civilians go to work, come home, spend time with their family, go to bed, and do it all over again. That's wonderful, but I can't picture that existence for me. It's get home from work and get out to a meeting and meet us and hang out, and God knows when we're going to get home, and we do it again. It's just a great way of living. Before I get going, I am on a short leash here. With Christmas a few days away, if you do celebrate Christmas, there was a time, I was thinking about this the other day, many years ago, it was about 1981, 82, and I took my first arrest just a couple of days before Christmas. And I was hanging out with someone in Lower Manhattan. If anyone knows that area, I was underneath the FDR Drive near the New York Post building, if anyone's familiar with that. And next thing, there was a banging on my window, and handcuffs went on. And I ruined Christmas for my entire family. They were taken hostage. And I remember I was at 100 Center Street waiting to see the judge. I think they call it the Tombs. And I'm petrified. I'm thinking I'm going to get the electric chair. I'm the only guy who's going to get the death sentence. And these are guys who've been in and out. They were better than lawyers, jailhouse lawyers. I'm scared to death. And all I kept telling myself, I get out of this one, I'll never do it again. I got released, and I went right back to where I got arrested as soon as I got out of there. And there were going to be many more arrests and many more ruined holidays and many more attempts at I just want to die until 1988 rolled around. And so, look, you know, we live life forward and understand it backwards. Looking back on it, even consequences, bad ones, couldn't keep me away from a drink. And I have a history of non-conference approved dry goods, too. It couldn't keep me away from that. But God could and would when I knocked on his door and he was sought. And that's what happened to me in 1988, June of 1988. I was living in an abandoned building in Lower East Side of Manhattan. I was homeless for a while and panhandling and in that life. And on June 23rd of 88, the very same God I had despised, quite frankly. I was never an atheist, but I hated God. I thought he was cruel, punitive, unjust, you name it. And it took my mom when I was just a kid, and my dad and I never got along. Bad things happened to me as a little boy, too, by some man. I was being molested. So I didn't believe in this loving God by the time I was 20, 28 years old. And the very same God who I've had these really bad feelings to is the very same God I beg for mercy. The bottom was brought to me in a place of, I didn't even have the ability to wallow in my own self-pity. I didn't have the ability to figure my life out. I was in a place of despair, such despair. You know that place where desperation screams louder than the ego for a brief moment? We kind of flatline, if you will. There were no options. There was no girlfriend. There was no job. There was nothing. It was me in an abandoned hallway. And I realized in this moment, I reek. I haven't bathed in God knows how long. And I'm dying. And I weighed about 130 pounds when I got into my 7 treatment center. And I had hepatitis C and I'm urinating blood and I'm dying. But in this hallway, I asked God to please take me from this. I don't want to die. I wasn't thinking about AA or treatment or detox or any of this stuff. I just don't want to die. And it's as raw as I could have been. God made me right size, if you will. And through a series of circumstances, I was placed in my 7 treatment center. And quite frankly, at the beginning, it was very bumpy for me. I was like kind of in survival mode, but I haven't looked back. I've been here since. It took 7 treatment centers. It took me to, you know, the Park Avenue park bench. I was the park bench guy. My first drunk came at 14 years old. I'm an old Brooklyn boy, Brooklyn, New York. And what we did back then, the older guys did, the worldly guys, the men who were like 17, they hung out on street corners and they drank Colt 45 beer in the summertime, was hanging out on a street corner, listening to music, flirting with the girls and roughhousing, and everyone wanted to be a gangster. And it was what I grew up with. And I wanted to be like those folks on a corner on a Saturday night, drinking and having some fun. But what was going on inside of me was just the opposite. You know, that fear-based, insecure, the square peg in a round hole. I have a story that's a secret that I was molested for a couple of years as a boy. My mom just took her own life via suicide. And my dad, you know, everyone's afraid of, including me. So I don't have a design for living. I don't know what to do. Now, none of that stuff makes me an alcoholic, but they are ingredients that went into making me who I was and how I operated out in the world, how I saw the world, how I heard the world, how I spoke. And it was a broken vessel right from the get-go. I've heard enough stories over the years. Many of us walk in with something called trauma, which is for professionals to kind of iron out. It doesn't make me an alcoholic, but all of those things were my blueprint. How I'm going to school, how I'm interacting with other people. Well, one Saturday night, a quart of Colt 45 beer went around and I grabbed hold of it and I began to drink. I'd never been drunk before, but halfway through a quart of beer, I'm feeling something I never experienced before. Now, Big Book talks about a sense of ease and comfort that comes at once by taking a few drinks. It was at once. Halfway through a quart of beer, I'm feeling nice. I'm traveling light for the first time. Maybe as you know, when I was doorknob high was the last time I traveled light. I'm feeling pretty good. And by the time I finish a quart of beer, I'm drunk and I know it. I can feel drunk. It's warm and fuzzy. I like it. Nothing can hurt me. I felt invincible. I was back in the saddle. And as an alcoholic who's always seeking control, when I was drunk, I felt in control. I was out of control, but I felt in control. Walking back to my dad's house, I had this thought, I'd never want to be sober again. I'm never going to make music again sober. I'm never going to play sports again sober. I'm not going to school sober. I want to be drunk for eternity. I love the effect produced by it. Yeah? I had no idea that my alcoholism doesn't come in a bottle of whiskey. Because when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous at 28 years old, physically sober, I'm still operating as an 18-year-old kid, completely untreated. I'm sounding alcoholic, I'm hearing alcoholic, and I don't have a drinking me. I can die from alcoholism without ever drinking. And that's where I was battling. And I don't realize, and this has happened to me in sobriety, how much bondage I am in until I taste a little bit of freedom. And I look back and say, why was I doing that? Why was I with this person? Why was I experiencing this? I'm out now. When I got drunk, I was out. And I waited for the following Saturday to roll around, and I got drunk. And progression does what progression does. And I started to drink a lot. And by the time I was around 19 years old, I'm not drinking beer, I'm drinking liquor now. And I get introduced to outside issues to make the liquor feel even better. Non-conference approved dry goods. And I love the effect produced by all of it. By the time I got into my fifth treatment center, I got the trifecta going. I got booze, pills, and heroin all going in my body at the same time. And that's all I'll say about drugs. This is Alcoholics Anonymous. My last two treatment centers was, over a number of years, was alcohol and taking sedatives. That was it. And I couldn't get out of that. So I go into my first treatment center around 19, 18, something like this. And I went there because I got caught stealing from my dad. And he put pieces of a puzzle together and placed me in my first treatment center. Now, I just know I start drinking. I don't like stopping. I had no idea about this phenomenon called craving. It's unbelievable. With folks like us, the first drink we have to take because the mind says you got to. And for some reason, I got to have a second drink. I don't get out. Figuratively, even literally, I'm glued to a bar stool and life is passing me by. I got to get home. I got to get to work. I got to see the kids. One more drink and I'll pay any price tomorrow to see comfort tonight. I'll do it tomorrow. I'll make it up tomorrow. I'll fix it tomorrow. But right now, I'm here, and I can't get out. It's a sad place for me to be, and I've gotten there when I can't even get there anymore from drinking. I'm not getting loaded. I'm not getting nice anymore. I'm drinking basically to breathe at the end, to stop the shaking and stop getting sick. That's my existence. Drink, eat some pills, I'm good, I'll figure it out tomorrow. And I can't get out. Many times I wanted to stop and quit just to continue doing it again. So I go to this treatment center for 30 days, I get out, and I'm drunk in an hour. In fact, 6 out of 7 treatment centers, if I wasn't locked up or in treatment, I was drunk or in the pursuit of getting money to get drunk. I wasn't a guy who bounced in and out of AA or had 30 or 60 or 90 days or a few months together and then realized. That's not my story. I had no time. 2 days of sobriety is what I was able to accomplish over 6 treatment centers over a number of years. I get out of treatment drunk within an hour. And the trapdoors have trapdoors, and I wind up making my second and third and fourth treatment center. And going into my fifth treatment center, my body's all marked up. They diagnosed me with this thing called hepatitis C. I lost my job. I was a longshoreman. I started as a longshoreman at Brooklyn Waterfront. Good money, great benefits, very, very powerful union. Maybe the second most powerful union in the country. You cannot get fired from this job. If you worked in New York and got fired, there'll be a work stoppage all the way to California. Nothing would move. You cannot get fired from this job. I got fired from that job. Yeah. There was no strike. Nothing. For all the stuff I was doing, my dad was one of the what they call shop stewards there, and I brought nothing but shame and embarrassment to him. I wouldn't show up for work, you know, doing a lot of illegal activities. Anything wasn't nailed down, I was taking it, that kind of thing. And they said, don't come to work anymore. And the guy who said that was my dad. Don't come here anymore. I'm firing you. And so I lost all of that. I go into my fifth treatment center, and they said, listen, you pick up a drink as soon as you leave. We're going to keep you a little bit longer. So they decided to hold on to me past the 30-day mark with 9 weeks. And back in the day, that was unheard of for an inpatient treatment center. It was 28, 30 days. I will tell you this. You know your life's not going well when your side of the door doesn't have a doorknob? That's not a good sign. And so after 9 weeks of being in treatment, I'm bathing, I'm eating, I'm going to group, they're taking me to physical therapy and all of those nice things. And I get discharged on a Saturday, and I'm drunk Monday. I was at my dad's house for a couple of days. I didn't know where to go. I called him collect. He had told me, get in a cab and just come home from Amityville, Long Island, back to, my dad was living in a place called Staten Island, New York. It's a long drive, so I'll pay the cab when it gets here. And I walked in the house, and my brothers weren't thrilled to see me. One brother said, what's he doing here? He's going to ruin everything. Because I took whatever didn't belong. I was a thief. I stole everything and brought it to the pawn shop or tried to sell it on the street because, God forbid, I should get a job. And so I'm drunk on Monday, and I remember I took a car that didn't belong to me. It was around 4 o'clock in the morning, and I cannot take Saturday, Sunday of not having anything in me. I need a drink. The world's going too fast. There's too much noise in the head. You know all the noise in the head we get, all the thinking that creates our current reality? Whatever my mind tells me, it must be true because I thought of it. But if you tell me that, well, that's crazy, but they're my thoughts, so it's true. And I can't take all the noise. And I sneak out of the house around 4 o'clock. I take a car that doesn't belong to me. I head to South Brooklyn, and I wait for the liquor store to open to buy one pint of whiskey and take the edge off. But no one's open. And I feel myself getting more agitated and more anxious and more uncomfortable. So I start to pace up and down on the sidewalk, waiting for this guy to open up the liquor store. And by the time he did, and I ran in there and put my money underneath the partition, it was a swanky joint, bulletproof glass, and I put my money underneath it. And he gives me a pint, and I go outside, I twist the cork, I start drinking. The cap off, and I start drinking. And immediately I felt relief. Now, what's really frightening about this is I was physically sober. My body didn't need alcohol or anything else that was going to affect me from the neck up with me. But my alcoholism doesn't come in a bottle of whiskey. My mind's screaming, we need a drink to slow life down, just to breathe, just to feel comfortable, to the point where it began to feel physical, like my body felt like it was sick. My hands are clammy, my forehead is sweating, I'm anxious, my heart's racing, I need something. And I finished the pint and it worked. I settled down, it took the edge off, I was okay. But as I said earlier, I'm an alcoholic, so I had to go back into the liquor store and buy a second pint. I'm not getting out. And I finished that, I'm getting drunk. And I went on a really, really bad one. I got in a lot of trouble, and I didn't see that coming. That wasn't in the forecast. The forecast was, we're just going to get a little drinky poo and take the edge off, and I had a really bad time out there. I got in trouble not only with the law, but with the wrong folks. And my dad would scoop me up and get me out of those jams over and over and over again. And I landed in my sixth treatment center. By the way, I'm out of insurance at this point. My poor dad is going into his pocket and forking over money to get me away from me, if you will. Over and over and over again. If it wasn't for the courage, strength, and direction that my Heavenly Father gave my dad, you'd have a different speaker here tonight, because it got me to you and you kept me alive and showed me a way of living. I walked out of my sixth treatment center after 36 hours. The realization of the damage I had done to my family and what I had done to my life burst upon me, and it was bad. In the big book, it says, we will tell you how we got out from under. I didn't think there was a way out from under. I'm too deep. I'm totally unemployed. I'm a homeless bum. Who's going to let me even go? Who's going to come near me? And the damage I did to my family, and I know I am not ever going to get sober. My mind is telling me it's not going to happen for you. So I had this idea that if I get out of here, I can just take my life and go away. This has been a big mistake. I don't belong here. It's been bad since I can remember. And I was in some flea bag motel in Staten Island, New York, and some woman who was a barmaid took pity on me. She said, I rent upstairs, take the couch, you can stay there. And one night when she finished the shift, I went into a pocketbook to steal the money that she made, and I found pills. I found a bunch of Valium, and I ate them and washed them down with alcohol and got on this couch, and I waited to die. I welcomed the idea of dying because it's the only thing I can come up with. It was so awful. And God interrupted my death, and I was on the streets. And all I couldn't consume enough alcohol to make the pain go away. And no matter how many times I went into treatment, once I pick up a drink, I need a second drink, and then I need a third drink, and then I need another drink. And I don't care what the consequences are. And when I'm not drinking, I'm restless here and discontented. And all my aliveness is dead, and that can happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. My first 6 months in here, I'm doing 2 and 3 meetings a day. I was living in Minnesota. And I can't even get comfortable in the rooms anymore. Because I'm way beyond restless here and discontented in 100 forms of fear. I'm not okay. I have no design for living, and all my mind is telling me, after this meeting, let's go get a drink. After the next meeting, let's go get a drink. And I'm basically holding my breath for 6 months, and I almost got loaded. And God's intervention, God's grace got in the way of that. I showed up at some guy's doorstep, this guy, Joe T, from St. Paul, Cottage Grove, Minnesota. And I got to his house, and I told him my plight, and he says, where are you with God in the 12 steps? I says, when do you start the steps? He said, when you stop throwing up, you're late. This disturbed me. I wanted a hug, and I understand, and let's have some coffee, and you know, that kind of warm and fuzzy stuff. He wasn't interested in my feelings. He saw a guy dying in front of him. I better give this guy the truth. He really annoyed me. But I heard him, and I didn't hear him with my mind. I heard him with my soul. I'll share this. What God has done, not only for me, but so many of us, without even steps in our life, just with a pure intent, I don't want to die, need help. God will close the ears to the mind and open up the ears to the soul. So we're hearing something for the first time, even though it's been spoken about many times prior. We're hearing it. I've heard Joe speak a million times. I don't hear anything. And then one day I walk in, suddenly I hear Joe, and he makes sense to me. And about a year later, I went to Minnesota after my 7th treatment center, by the way. And I was in Amityville, Long Island for the 7th time. About 2 weeks later, they sent me out to Minnesota, lived out there for a year. I was brought to my first home group in Brooklyn, and I found my first sponsor. And I've had wonderful, wonderful men sponsor me out of this book. And there was a time where I got worshiping the mechanics. I became mechanical. And I forgot that this is a treasure map that takes me to the treasure. I thought this was the treasure. I love the book. I love the mechanics. But they're vehicles to take me that power, which is allowing me to do the steps in the meantime. I had to find out, like most of my lessons, the hard way, that I do the steps not to keep me sober, but do the steps to experience the power which has kept me sober all along. He's always present. He's always consistent. And so I'm able to step into a new place in my life where, you know, it says we alcoholics are undisciplined. I had to get disciplined. But my discipline, quite frankly, has turned into devotion. With God, with Alcoholics Anonymous, with prayer, with meditation, this whole life that we're in has gone from discipline to devotion. That doesn't make me better than anyone. It's just my walk. Because this speaker, me, is broken and flawed. This is a broken toy you're looking at. Well, I'm a car. When it drives away, leaves a big oil spot on the ground. The door squeaked. Well, anyone over 60 knows about squeaking, so I don't think I'm any further. I used to wake up and run over to the coffee pot. I kind of mambo very slowly over to the coffee pot, and my body makes all these weird sounds now, but that's me. I will cause a traffic jam on 95 when I'm the only guy on the road because of something called thinking. And it seems to me when I'm in disease and discomfort, I forgot about God. And when I'm in a place of ease and comfort, I've remembered about God. So my job is to chop wood, carry water, plow the field, let God do the growing, and pass this on for fun and for free with the same love and gratitude that you bring it to me with. Every time I walk into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been not only over the country, but to Europe many times for Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I walk into a room, they say, "Hi, welcome." Not like, "Who are you?" Which is what I'm used to. Who are you? Who do you know? You know, it's just welcome at the door. I have a cup of coffee, sit down, I leave with a whole bunch of new friends. Only in AA. It's the greatest place in the world for me. That's all I got. Peace.